welcome to the France 24 debate. I'm Charlie James, and today we're examining the impact a new Trump era will have on international affairs. Donald Trump was elected for a second time on an America First agenda, and we know from his first term that he is not afraid to break norms on the world stage. So what can we expect from Trump's foreign policy agenda this time around? We have a panel of experts to help us try to decode just that, starting here in the studio with political scientist Kevin Arsenault. You are also, hello there.
Hello.
You are also the director of the Political Science Research Center at Sciences Po University. Thanks so much for being with us. And joining us remotely as well, we from Brussels, for the EU perspective, we have Alva Finn, Executive Director of the European Liberal Forum, which is a liberal think tank. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate you taking the time. And from New York, Stephen Greenhouse, who is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, where he writes about American labor and wages. He is also the author of the book Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Thank you, sir, for being here. And Stephen, I would like to start with you. We are going to first talk about how Trump's America First outlook really resonated with voters. And I want to just watch Trump explaining the goal of his America First agenda. This was just on November 1st. Going to watch Trump, if we can, back on November 1st, explaining his America First agenda. Do we have that?
Never apologize for defending America. I will protect our workers. I will protect our jobs. I will protect our borders. I will protect our families. And I will protect the birthright of our children to live in the richest and most powerful nation on the face of the earth again. And as we rescue our economy, I will also restore our borders.
You know, Stephen, labor, working for a living, it is the one thing that connects American voters across all genders, races, classes. And we saw that here. The economy was the number one issue for all voters across all demographics. As an expert in American labor, can you tell us why this America First agenda resonated so much on Election Day?
That's a great question, Charlie. Very nice to be here. So, unfortunately, a lot of Americans feel that they're doing very poorly economically. A very high percentage of Americans say the nation is heading in the wrong direction. 60-70% say the U.S. economy is in poor condition. The truth is, you know, the American economy is in very good shape. You know, our unemployment rate is very low, down to 4%. You know, of the G7 nations, the United States has by far the highest economic growth since the pandemic. You know, growth in economic growth in the U.S. has been four times as fast as economic growth in France over the past few years. Yet a lot of Americans feel, well, we were battered, hurt by inflation, and they blame that on Biden. They blame that on Harris. And inflation is way down. It's, you know, down near 2% now in the United States, but people are still very angry. And they don't want to accept that the inflation wasn't caused by Biden or Harris. It was caused by the pandemic and the, you know, and the supply chain disruptions and by the war in Ukraine and how that pushed up gas prices and food prices. And I think a lot of Americans feel, you know, that they're not as successful as they would like, and they need people to blame. And Trump comes along and says, America first. We're spending way too much money defending Ukraine in the war. I mean, we shouldn't be spending the $60 billion helping Ukraine fight against Putin. We should be spending the $60 billion here in the United States. We shouldn't be allowing in all these immigrants. You know, America first, we should protect American workers, American-born workers. And a lot of people, you know, Trump really, you know, points to scapegoats. You know, our problems are China. Our problems are spending too much money on Ukraine. Our problems are immigrant workers. And a lot of Americans have bought into Trump's notion, conception, that, you know, something's very broken and we, the nation, aren't focusing nearly enough on Americans. And Harris said, you know, we're a great nation. The economy's doing well. You know, we're the leader of you know, the free world, you know, we're the, you know, the leader of the Atlantic Alliance, and it's important for us to defend Ukraine. It's important for us to sustain NATO, and we can do that. And, you know, that strengthens America, that strengthens the American economy. And it's wrong to go off in this nativist, xenophobic America first direction.
So what is it then exactly about foreign policy that Trump has promised to do that is going to put more money in the pockets of American workers?
So, for instance, Trump has hinted he will end the war in Ukraine on his first day in office, which means basically, you know, handing victory over to Putin. And that means we'd stop spending $10, $20, $30, $40, $50 billion in helping Ukraine. And in theory, you know, that tax money could be used for, you know, to build roads or send rockets into space. Second, you know, part of his biggest thing, main platform, is to have tariffs. And he's talked about imposing tariffs on all imported goods of up to 20%. So it's goods from France, goods from Germany, goods from Britain, goods from Vietnam. You know, we'd all face import taxes of 20%, and imports from China would face tariffs of 60%. And, you know, of course, European nations are very unhappy about this. China is very unhappy about this. Japan is very unhappy about this. Our allies are very unhappy about this. And there's real. So while Trump says this would be great for American workers, it will help create, it will help reduce imports and thereby create many factory jobs, many manufacturing jobs. Many economists say Trump's idea for tariffs are a horrible idea. They'll raise the cost of everything in the United States. You know, they'll raise cost of imports, you know, by 20%, and a lot of other non-imported products will be able to raise their prices as well. And another huge fear is Trump's big tariffs are going to spark a trade war, not just with China, but with our friends in Europe. And that could create a disaster in international relations. And that might also push the United States and other nations into recession. And that could push millions of U.S. workers and European workers and elsewhere out of jobs. And you know, Trump says, I'm a champion of workers. I'm going to really help workers. But many economists are saying, including a letter signed by 23 American economists who won the Nobel Prize, saying Trump's economic policies are bad for the nation. They will increase inflation. They will push up the federal budget deficit, and they will increase the chances of recession.
We have a late joiner to the debate here, but who we are very happy to have, Randy Yalouz. He is a French-American lawyer and president of Republicans Overseas Action. You are a Trump supporter. So
I represent Trump now in the Republican Party here in France and in the world, exactly.
So we're happy to have you here to help explain the president-elect's vision. Stephen was just giving his view of, and the economist's view of, how Trump's America First agenda could potentially harm the global economy. But if you could just break down for us what Trump's argument is exactly about the America First agenda and its main points and why it's the right move.
I've spoken already to other economists about Trump's policy regarding tariffs that he applied in his prior term. And when you look at his application, though, he made it simpler for the Americans to hear, and that's how policy is explained to the American public, that we're going to be increasing tariffs from 10 to 12%. But he did it very wisely in his prior term, and it was done very carefully, and it was used for specific areas to be able to help and have a balanced approach for competition purposes, because we were put in a competitive disadvantage with China, and to make it more a level playing field, he did so. He increased it, whether it was in steel, iron, or whether it was for furniture. When he went to North Carolina, that's where he made a speech about it, and he says, I'm going to increase on certain types of furniture the tariffs so you can be more competitive. So I think you shouldn't just generalize it, and I think it was very responsible the way he applied his policies regarding tariffs. And we had an amazing trade agreement with China that was negotiated by Trump, and I feel that there's a tendency to want to discredit his experience, his knowledge, what he will do going forward on how he's going to treat trade policy, because he had a very good deal, and everybody was so proud of what Trump was doing, is that the European Union even decided in 2020, after Trump made an amazing deal with China, which forced them to spend $200 billion in purchases per year on American products, that the Europeans abandoned the preferential treatment they were giving to China in 2020. They had no tariffs or lower tariffs on specific products with China. So this is an incentive that's done to try to create a more level playing field. And I think you need smart, intelligent protectionism. No one's saying to just do an overthrow. I think that's an exaggeration to say it. And he will work on with his teams, and he'll apply a very smart protectionist approach to dealing with these issues. And he has to treat each area specifically. And he'll have experts working with him and explain this area should help this industry. We're having difficulties in these types of industries. And that's how the things will be made and done. And it helped push the Europeans to have a similar approach. It's a sort of a trickle effect when it comes to Europe. Europe always follows our trade policies that we did. And then to give you an example with China, that was what happened. Look what we did with NAFTA also. You have to look back on how we renegotiate parts of the NAFTA agreement between Canada and Mexico. I know they were upset about it, but at the same time, it started bringing jobs back. And we were building factories back in America for things, telling companies that they had to build those back, bring back the specific industries back into America. And that's what needs to be done, and have an overall approach.
Well, and one of the ways that Trump argues he is going to bring jobs and manufacturing back to America is with hefty tariffs. He has spoken about this a lot on the campaign trail. I think it's kind of a heady topic for a lot of people to understand.
Yes, but when you say hefty, you know, Trump, there's rhetoric for saying hefty, and there's, when it comes to hefty, and it's saying applying those politics, because for people to say, let me explain to an American, oh, I'm going to increase tariffs by 10, 20%. When an American says, well, 10 and 20% is maybe not a lot to them, but when they say maybe there'll be specific areas where you apply those hefty tariffs in specific areas, very pinpoint areas of business that need to have a more level playing field where we're having issues with specific countries, whether it be China or whatever. But I think across the board, you have to go look back at what he did on his term from 2017 to 2020 to see how he approached and dealt with trade policy. And that's what he's going to do. And I think selling point is another thing, and having, when it's applying, it's another thing. And I think Trump has done that in the past when he sat down the table and he says, I need to have a real agreement. I need to sit down, look at the numbers, look at different things, and he will apply a much more real-world approach and how he's going to create a more level playing field with our trade partners, whether it be with certain areas in Europe, it may occur, it will be in Asia with China, India, and that's what's going to happen, most certainly.
We will see soon how he intends
to apply honestly
this.
He did it between 2016 and 2020. I don't see why he would change his approach, and it was a smart trade policy that he was applying.
Well, one of the things that Trump has said he considers his secret weapon, both domestically and with foreign policy, is his unpredictability. He has called it his signature political weapon. To the Wall Street Journal, in October, he said that he wouldn't have to threaten China with the use of American military force over Taiwan because President Xi Jinping, quote, respects me and knows I'm F-word crazy. So Trump sees this uncertainty, sees this unpredictability definitely as a plus. But Alva, I want to ask you, with the view from Brussels, what about U.S. allies? How did this unpredictability come into play for U.S. allies during Trump's first term? And how are they preparing for it now during his second?
Well, today in Budapest, European leaders are now talking about this exact thing. And I was just reading through some comments that Mark Rutte made. He was there as the Prime Minister of the Netherlands in the past, and now is the SecGen of NATO. And one thing that he talked about was that Trump actually moved NATO forward. Now we have over 20 European and other NATO members who are paying over 2%. And this was a key thing that Trump really pushed forward, as well as the war in Ukraine. So they're, I think, talking about working together. They have said they don't know what he's going to do. So you've already addressed that element of unpredictability. So they're a little bit waiting to see what his proposals are. I mean, there has been a lot of hand-wringing and anxiety around some statements he made about leaving NATO, but that remains to be seen whether or not he would do something like that. Maybe he's just saying it in order to push Europe forward. If it is true that the US would leave NATO, well, then that just means that we need to flex our muscles. Europe needs to stand on its own two feet. We've known that since the last Trump presidency, but it would have been the same with Kamala Harris. We already saw US moving away from us on things like the IRA, which was quite unpopular with the European partners. We really felt we were kind of left behind there. Now it seems like there's almost a race to protectionism, which we do not want. We want to work with the US. But if there are tariffs being brought in, including on European products, you can guarantee that they are talking about this now at this summit and deciding what they're going to do from the European point of view. But I was also looking at the comments, for example, from our own Prime Minister and from Ireland. Yeah, he's right. He's a businessman and he knows that inter-EU-US trade is crucial to the US economy. So I think there is, even though he can be unpredictable, I think we managed to work together the last time, and we have a lot of experience in the summit now from some leaders, including liberals, who worked well, and they are prepared. That seems to be the message, including from Alexander De Croo today. He just said, we've been planning for this for years for another Trump presidency. So hopefully we will see a plan coming out.
And we can actually speak a little bit more about this summit. That's 50 European leaders who are gathering in Budapest, Hungary. And with the election of Donald Trump, the talks are largely focused, as you said, on how the EU is going to navigate these next few years. Our reporter Solange Mujon has prepared a report looking deeper into the issues that they are discussing at the summit.
It is a summit hosted by an ally of Donald Trump's, with Viktor Orban at the helm of the European presidency until the end of the year. Under the motto, Make Europe Great Again, some 50 leaders, including the heads of NATO and the president of Ukraine, gathered in Budapest for talks. One of their main topics, how to navigate another Trump presidency, and if it is possible to do so as a unified front, or whether divisions between European nations are too great. There's the issue of Europe's security challenges, namely the war in Ukraine, which Donald Trump has vowed to end in 24 hours. This has created fears that he could back a peace deal that favors Russia. Emmanuel Macron said Europe's role here must be a united one.
Peace, as Volodymyr Zelensky just said, means helping Ukraine resist the Russian war of aggression. There may be differences in perspective around this table, but I am deeply convinced that our interests are the same. Our interest is that Russia does not win this war.
European leaders are also discussing how Russia, North Korea, China, and Iran are thought to be working together. For the head of NATO, this means alliances must be strengthened.
And it is a threat not only to the European part of NATO, but also to the US mainland. And that means that the Indo-Pacific and the Euro-Atlantic, but particularly also within NATO, US, Canada, and the European part of NATO, we have to work together.
Yet Trump's relationship with NATO is a fraught one. He's threatened to leave the alliance. For the head of the EU Council, it is high noon for Europe to become less reliant on the United States.
My conviction is very, very simple. In fact, we have to be more master of our destiny, not because of Donald Trump or Kamala Harris, but because of our children.
Another issue that European leaders are discussing extensively, what could happen if Donald Trump slaps steep tariffs on European goods, which could damage global trade and the EU economy.
So, Alva, with your experience, would you say that that Europe is ready to, in a sense, go it alone when it comes to the war in Ukraine, to NATO, if they need to?
Yes, absolutely. I think we've had many discussions about strengthening the European pillar in NATO if we need to. You can see that spending has gone up massively since 2019 in almost all EU NATO members. We've also been talking about having more of a defence and security approach within the European Union. So, I mean, in our think tank, which is a think tank of the Liberals, we've been talking about, you know, having joint European defence and security projects, also working together on things like cyber security and cyber threats, which have only grown. And we've seen a lot of that in recent elections. So interference, foreign interference, cyber security threats during election time. These are all things that have put security and defence up at the top of the EU agenda now. We will even have a commissioner on defence going forward. So that's on defence. And then on Europe's competitiveness, that is now the other priority of the European Union. I was just today at an industry meeting talking to industry about the fact that Europe needs to wake up. And we have had two famous reports now from two former prime ministers of Italy, the Letta report and the Draghi report, all focused on completing the single market, which is basically the crown jewel of the European Union, and making sure that we take it seriously that Europe is lagging behind China and the US. So, yes, I think we have plans already in place, and they predate the election cycle. The European Commission also put a task force together in order to deal with fallout from a Trump win. But many of the things would have been the same, even if it was a Democrat in the White House.
Political scientist Kevin Arsenault, I want to ask you about how the American public feels about Trump's relationships with strongman leaders, Vladimir Putin, Viktor Orban. We had Bolsonaro in Brazil, Netanyahu in Israel. You know, Trump projects himself as a strongman style leader. And it seems, by the way that the American public voted, that they're more comfortable with that than people might have thought.
Well, I think that in a lot of ways, what we have to appreciate about American voters is that they often, these sort of foreign policy issues are often not at the top of their heads when they're voting. And so one of the things that I think that we saw in Donald Trump's first term was that he was very willing to sit down and talk with leaders around the world that previous administrations held at much more of an arm's length. I actually think that, you know, the sort of the press at the time in the United States sort of made a big deal about this in the idea that this would essentially hurt Donald Trump, but it really didn't. I think what he learned from that, and what we learned from that, is that the American public actually gives presidents a wide latitude to do foreign relations, as long as people believe that the president is putting America's interests first. Then I think they. American presidents can do most of the things that they want. Now, in terms of the sort of base of your question, you know, it is interesting that it does seem that Donald Trump, in the way that he talks and his rhetoric, that he admires the style of leadership that we see in Hungary and in Russia, that doesn't really accord with sort of the standard notions of liberal democracy. Now, I think some of this is difficult to, you know, I think folks on the left would say this is clear evidence that Donald Trump is a wannabe authoritarian. And I think people on the right would say, well, if you think about it, though, these leaders also support the sorts of political issues, the sort of an ideology that Donald Trump shares as well. So in some sense, this could be about ideological infinity and not a desire to bring authoritarianism to the United States. But nonetheless, it is noteworthy.
I want to zoom in now on a couple of specific challenges that Donald Trump will face on day one as president. First is the war between Russia and Ukraine. We heard, Randy, I want to direct this to you, but we heard Stephen at the beginning of the show talking about how Trump has said that he will end the war in Ukraine in 24 hours. Do we have any clues about how he would intend to do this?
I think people getting back to our guest, what he was saying about Trump, and I think it's important because, again, some people think that, I don't know why you'd want to treat Mr. Orban as authoritarian. I can understand you have that approach maybe regarding Putin. He was elected, and if you spend some time in Budapest, which I have, you'd be seeing that the media is very, very expanded. You have media that's to the left, center and right. It's a very, very balanced society, unlike in the U.S., which is very much to the left, the media, or here in France, where the media is predominantly to the left. They're just saying that's where things are. It's important to say, so we, I think we have to be very careful when we try to label in liberal democracies that we have leaders, strongman leaders, and consider them because they have these strong qualities, that they don't reflect the culture of the people that have elected them. And I think that's important. You have to trust the people, and the people have elected them, and tomorrow when their term is over, they move on. So there's no reason to think that an authority, it's a strong character, a strong person, doesn't necessarily make them authoritarian because they rule within the rule of law. That's the big difference when you talk about authority. It's a question of style is different, and I think we'd make that difference, okay? Now, getting back to Putin and...
I see all of us shaking her head
no,
quite a bit as
you speak. No, but she can have her opinion.
So
I don't mind. She has her opinion, and the other ones will have their opinion. Excuse me, because I think it's very, very... When you say authoritarian, there is a big issue regarding whether you're putting on the same... same table someone like Putin, Orban, or you're saying Trump, or Netanyahu, which I think is a very, very unfair and somewhat of a saying to stress that, well, you're in a democratically elected individuals and you're comparing them to, no, you can shake your heads, excuse me. I think that's a poor example to use. I could say the same thing when we're looking at the UK minister, what's his practices regarding freedom of expression. We could say his approach to dealing with freedom of expression and many UK citizens as being authoritarian. So
I'd like to hear what Alva... I saw her shaking her head when
But I'll get back to Russia, Putin. I think the same approach...
I'm going to come back to that. I just want to hear from Alva because I saw you shaking your head when he was talking, when Randy was talking about the media environment in Hungary.
Yes, unfortunately... This is something that we have experience with in the Liberals. We have a Liberal Party called Momentum in Hungary, and they've been attacked. The use of lawfare against some MPs. The overall media environment owned by him. He has tried to shut down essentially civil society in the country. So yes, you can make very a comparison to Putin. He's used some of the exact same playbook. And yes, he also talks very highly of him. So with all respect, you don't really know what you're talking about.
With all due respect, you don't know what you're talking about too when you looking at to yourself what's happening in the United States regarding to media, what's happened in the last elections regarding Trump. We can easily say that the Democrats were authoritarian in the same way where he was not permitted, he was thrown off the social media regarding Facebook, Twitter during the election. So please don't give me a lesson about because you have differences.
Well, it's not a lesson. We're here to
No. I know because you
different
aren't have
viewpoints.
Frictions. Yes,
so
I've spoken to parties. This is your view, and I expect when you're saying authoritarian, when people work and using the rule of law, so when you're having lawfare in specific countries, then you're going to say you can't use them. When working in a democracy, we're within the democracy. If you're going to say that someone's authoritarian, it's just giving your point of view. So I prefer that you don't use those type of things when you're dealing with liberal democracies because we aren't a democracy.
Well, but we're also here at a debate, and I feel like we should all be open to hearing each other's perspectives. Like, that's the point of this forum.
Yes, but I think it's one-sided.
I want to get Stephen in here, too, because I see him raising his hand. Stephen.
I'm sorry. I think some of the things you're saying are just false. To say the media in the United States is leftist is wrong. The mainstream media is very down the middle.
No.
The Washington Post didn't endorse anybody. The Los Angeles Times didn't endorse anybody. It's different from France where the mainstream media tries to be very neutral. Then there's Fox News, which is extremely pro-Trump. And for you to say that the media
Fox News is the only example, sir. You're being false. False.
We all know that Orban has worked for years to suppress voices that criticize him. And as to what you said about tariffs, you kind of accused Donald Trump of lying when he said,
not at all.
I might do 20% tariffs, I'm going to do 60% tariffs against China. Now you say, well, he might not do that at all. He might do much less.
No, I said he'll do it on certain areas.
This, Yeah. On one hand, you say the targeted tariffs in his first term are great, but now he wants to do blunderbuss across the board tariffs, which I think you implicitly say is a very bad idea. And Trump, for some reasons that are very hard to comprehend, is a huge admirer of Vladimir Putin, who is a brutal dictator. And when Trump says, I will end the war against Ukraine in 24 hours, you know, there's only one way for him to do that. He's not going to see through a negotiated settlement between Zelensky and Putin. He's basically going to tell Zelensky, sorry, we, the United States, are going to stop aiding you, period. And Zelensky will know without that it'll be very, very hard to win. And Trump, I fear, will basically tell Putin, you could have what we want. We're happy for you to annex the Donbas region and other parts of Ukraine. And Trump, unfortunately, has this weird affection for authoritarian-minded leaders like Bolsonaro and Orban and Putin.
You enjoy staying, Mr. Greenhouse. Let me give you, you're very unfair and you misstate facts. And I think, again, your reflection,
I
think
not
people will, let me explain
that
to you.
Wrong.
And I think because you know perfectly well what happened with the Washington and Los Angeles Times regarding these elections for 40 years that they've been sponsoring the Democratic Party. It's very important because
we're supposed to be speaking about the foreign policy of Donald Trump, not the American
media's saying that
bias
he's
or
saying
non-bias.
That there's a bias and there is bias.
I would like, Randy, to hear your perspective.
Let me give you an example.
On what Donald Trump will do to end the war in Ukraine.
I think Trump, his own personality and unpredictability, and I think the very sense that why we're even here debating about is his personality that disturbs each one of you is exactly what will make things change. Look what's happened. The Hamas just released a statement saying that they want to end the violence with Israel after within 48 hours of the election. So we have a statement from Hamas, who started a war. And we have the Biden and Harris administration. We were unable to get a statement from the Hamas that they're willing to end violence
with
Israel.
But when it comes
Israel.
To Russia,
Russia,
do you think he's
will
going
deal,
to do?
Is that more complicated approach? But what I want to explain to you is that's this unpredictability. And your issues today is that you have a man with a personality that's been able to push his adversaries to a certain position where they will accept conditions where you have a Harris and a Biden administration were unable to do their job. He was elected. Hamas says, okay, we're willing to end the war. You understand Putin is today, he's sitting there waiting. He knows what to expect. He knows who Trump is. He knows his character. He knows what may occur. And I know Zelensky also has to deal with these different issues. And at the same time, the way this war went was poorly managed by the Europeans and especially the Americans under the Biden administration, because there was a peace deal on the table within 4 months in 2022. Boris Johnson was there sitting with the Russians and Zelensky, and the Americans under Biden and Harris decided to say to Boris Johnson, no, continue the war. Within 4 months, we would have had a peace deal on the table. So don't tell me that the U.S. is pragmatic and cares about the Ukrainians and cares about the deaths of the Russians and the Ukrainians. Over a million deaths. They just want to push it. They're neoconservatives that want to push a war.
Olga, can you provide a little bit of context for us here? So when it comes to the war in Ukraine, what is the fear from the European perspective beyond the funding? If Trump does say, I'm going to end this war quickly, the message that sends, particularly in Eastern Europe, what are the fears around that?
Yeah, in order to have a peace deal, both sides have to agree to it. And what happened with, what you're talking about is that it wasn't a deal. It wasn't acceptable to the Ukrainians. They have been very clear, including with Trump, and Zelensky has spoken at length also at the summit that I've just spoken about. They are not willing to cede land that is theirs to Russia in order to end the war. I think, I'm from Ireland, so we have had famous peace deals obviously in Northern Ireland, and that really relies on both sides getting a good deal. And Donald Trump is obviously famous for the art of the deal. Now, do I think if he's willing to cede large portions to Russia of Ukraine, that is not a good deal for the Ukrainians. It's also not a good deal for Europe. It sends a bad message that any country can start invading illegally another country on European territory. That is unacceptable. So we will not accept a bad deal from the European side, and the Ukrainians certainly won't accept it either.
I want to make sure we touch on the war in Gaza as well, because this was a big issue for American voters in the election. Trump is close with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, but he also appears to not be happy about the war in Gaza. Here's what Trump said on November 4th, just the day before the election.
I will stop the chaos in the Middle East. It would have never happened again. Israel would have never been attacked on October 7th. And I will prevent World War III from happening. I know all the players.
Kevin, I've heard people in interviews and relatives actually even tell me that, there were these wars that happened under Biden. This wouldn't have happened under Trump. I mean, what is the role of the war in Gaza when it came to the vote and just this idea of like Trump as a peacemaker?
I think that it's always hard to know what would have happened, under a different set of conditions. What we can say is that, I think that what I can say about the direct answer to your question is that probably the position that that the Biden administration took was a standard American position to support Israel, and I don't see that changing under Donald Trump either. And that did, I think, cost Harris a number of votes, especially in Michigan. Whether it changed the outcome of the election, I probably not. Now, in terms of whether or not Donald Trump should be seen as a peacemaker on this, I think that I think one thing that I'll agree with Randy about is that Donald Trump's brand of foreign policy is one of being unpredictable, and that unpredictability causes the sides of the sort of in this case in Gaza to not be sure what position the Americans will take. Now, this is something that the Israelis didn't have to really wonder about with Biden. They knew what position the Americans were going to take because American foreign policy, standard of American foreign policy since World War II, has been to take very clear positions. So Donald Trump has basically sort of broken that convention. Now, whether that brings about peace, we'll see. Right? That is the gamble. The gamble is that by being unpredictable, by having either side of sort of conflicts, not be sure how America is going to intervene, might lead them to sort of work out their differences, mm-hmm. rather than depending on the Americans to sort of come in and sort of play world police. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, we'll see how it plays out.
Now, Stephen, whether or not Trump could have avoided Hamas from attacking Israel in the first place, come January 20th, the war in Gaza is his problem. It's in his hands, his challenge. Do we have any idea of what we could expect Trump to do differently from Biden when it comes to Gaza, especially since he does have this special relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu?
I think, Biden and Harris were quite supportive to very supportive of Netanyahu. They did say, try to put some limits on the amount of bombing that Israel did of Gaza and in Lebanon. And Trump has generally been 1,000% behind Netanyahu. I was listening to an interview with a prominent Palestinian American in the state of Michigan, where there are a lot of Arab Americans, and he said, "I can't support Harris because Harris hasn't been supportive enough of the Palestinians. She's been too supportive of Israel." And this Palestinian American said, "But my uncle, my Palestinian uncle on the West Bank, called me and said, it's crazy for you not to support Harris, because if Trump wins, he's going to back Netanyahu 100%, 1,000%, and let Israel do whatever it wants. It will let, you know, Trump would let Netanyahu totally wipe out, you know, people in Gaza. So I think the reason Hamas now called for, you know, an immediate ceasefire is that it really worries that Trump is going to, you know, give a huge green light to Netanyahu to do whatever he wants, whereas Biden, while supportive, gave a yellow light saying, you know, try, please. You've killed so many civilians already. Try not to kill so many more. Whereas I think, you know, many Americans, many diplomats fear that Trump will give a green light to Netanyahu to do whatever he wants.
We have just a few minutes left, and I want to discuss what is widely seen as one of, if not the most important position in the cabinet, that is Secretary of State. I'm wondering if each of you could give me maybe an idea of who you would either like or who you think Trump might pick for this position. Randy, can we start with you? We've heard Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, who is also under consideration for vice president, floated. What are your thoughts?
That's a strong potential. I think he didn't give too many hints to it. I think it's going to be a very, very important decision for him. I think it's under major consideration. I didn't think he, even during the campaign, he didn't talk about much about it. We all agree on that. It's because I think it's very important for him to have his control of who's going to put in that place. And I think he's in the process of deciding different individuals. It was the same thing that was done when he chose to Vance at the last minute as vice president. I think you'll hear the Secretary of State will be the one that the last minute you'll hear the nomination, because it's quite important, and I think the most important ones will be at the last minute, and no one's going to know them in advance, because it's something, in my view, it's hard to say. I think there are several people, and I prefer that you ask our colleagues about it. Because honestly, Mr. Rubio, I think, is a good candidate for it. He has experience, but today, it's hard to say. I know there are people that potentially could do it. I know there are ones
He's a superstitious person, too, so he doesn't often think about these things too far in advance because he doesn't want to jinx the election. So it's possible that, he's just kind of starting to make these decisions
on the table,
now.
I believe that there were strong supporters. I think that he's going to... Rubio is a potential...
But not Elon Musk.
Musk, no. I don't think Musk... Musk already... it won't be Musk. It won't be Ramaswamy, even though I think at one point he was saying maybe he would be interested at one point, but I don't think he's going to be taking that position. But again, Musk, again, is not interested in that position. And again, people that
he does have a lot of businesses to run.
No, but if you look around his entourage, and that's what's very interesting. Lisa Crusay, I think the 5-6 people around him that were closest to him during his campaign, none of them have really expressed their desire to be Secretary of State. That's what I'd like to say, is that you always see this 5-6 different people that were very close to Donald Trump during that period, at least to say that. So that's
we have just 1 minute left. I want to see if I can get Stephen and Alva and your opinions.
I agree with Randy. Marco Rubio would be a good choice. He's very respected. He's a very good speaker. It would certainly help solidify Trump's support from the Hispanic community. I think Nikki Haley would be a very good choice. It would be Donald Trump's way of showing he wants a Republican Party that's not just a MAGA tent, but a broader tent. But Nikki Haley might be too much of an internationalist for the American First people who are backing Trump.
Alva, quickly, any projections?
Yeah, I mean, maybe Mike Pompeo again. Who knows? I doubt it will be Nikki Haley, given what has transpired. I don't think he's a very forgiving person. So, I'd say probably, though, I think Marco Rubio would be the best choice out of the three.
Okay, we've got 3 votes for Marco Rubio. Kevin, how do you feel?
I'll vote for Marco Rubio too, but what I'll say is it's really hard to predict what he's going to do at this point. He is unpredictable. My prediction would be, unlike the last time where I think he actually really ceded this decision over to a lot of elites within the Republican Party who tried to use that to kind of put guardrails around this new guy who didn't really know how things worked. This time, this is the second time in the office, I think he kind of knows how things work now, and I think he's going to pick somebody for that position that is going to be able to push his America First agenda forward. So I think he's going to pick somebody, like he did pick J.D. Vance, that is going to go after his vision.
I want to thank you all for joining us here today on the France 24 debate. Stephen Greenhouse, Alva Finn, Kevin Arsenault, and Randy Yalouz. Thank you for the spirited conversation.
Thank you.
And Francois Picard will be back next week to take over the debate. Once again, I appreciate you joining me, Charlie James, here today.